Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the Global X Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Battleground with me, Patrick Bishop, and Saul David. Well, the dam of Republican obstructiveness has finally broken in Washington, and $61 billion worth of military aid will soon be pouring into Ukraine from the US. How soon is, of course, a matter of vital importance.
We'll be looking into what happens next and asking whether the weaponry and ammunition will arrive in time to make a difference to the great battle that is brewing around the heavily fortified hilltop town of Chasiv Yar, a crucial strategic feature which the Russians are expected to attack any day now.
We'll also be talking to intrepid Canadian investigative journalist Justin Ling, who'll be talking to us about the extraordinary technological developments he found on his recent trip to Ukraine and how they're shaping the battlefield and the course of the war. He's written a brilliant article, by the way, in Wired magazine, which is coming out on Monday. But before we get to that, Saul, this saga of the blocked funds in Congress, it's been running for 6 months, so it feels like a lot longer, doesn't it? Now that the help is on its way, the question, of course, is what difference is this likely to make in the immediate and longer term?
Well, it will make a lot of difference, actually, Patrick. And it is, I mean, we cannot stress how important this news is and what a victory, in inverted commas, this is for Ukraine. We've been flagging up the possibility that there might be a change in Johnson, who's the Speaker of the House of Representatives, which was really where the logjam was. That's exactly what's come to pass. Whether it was for the reasons we gave a few episodes ago, we don't know. But it doesn't matter, because today the Senate have confirmed that. And of course, Biden is going to pass this as quickly as possible. He'll sign the bill immediately. And a Pentagon spokesman has said that the first new U.S. supplies, military supplies, could arrive before the end of April. So that's just a few days from now. How is this possible? Well, the U.S. could send in weapons already in the bases of its own forces stationed in Europe and replenish them later. And apparently that was all planned. They knew if this vote was passed that the kit would be needed very quickly. So they made sure that they could get a lot of it to their sort of forward bases. President Biden is expected to announce a package that could be worth more than $1 billion as early as next week. And this includes more equipment that the US has already provided, but of which, of course, they've run out of now. And that includes ammunition, high mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, Stingers, much needed 150mm artillery rounds, infantry fighting vehicles, Humvees, Javelins. I mean, the list is endless, but you can see, given all the points we've been making for weeks and weeks and months now, how absolutely vital all of this is. But very importantly, President Zelensky is saying that he has managed to finalize agreements on the supplies of long-range guided missiles, the ATACMS that we've mentioned before. Now, of course, they have been in Ukraine and being used for a while now, but not the long-range ones. Kyiv's long been seeking them as part of its bid to strike deep behind Russian lines, and it appears that it's now going to have the capability. And the significance of all of this, we're going to hear from Justin, actually, about some of the extraordinary technology that's enabling the Ukrainians to use these long-range drone strikes. But if they've got the ATACMS as well, which can be fired up to 300 kilometers in range, then they really can do some serious damage, particularly in the Crimean Peninsula. The news out of Washington has also been met with new promises from its European allies, with the UK announcing on Tuesday that its largest ever military aid package for Ukraine, valued at £500 million, will be on its way soon. And of course, on top of that is the latest announcement that Britain is going to be increasing its defence spending to 2.5% of GDP by 2030. And that is a significant increase. And its importance has been underlined by the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, who said, you know, Britain is leading the way now. The rest of Europe needs to step up and follow. So it's all very encouraging on many levels, Patrick. But as to the bigger picture, what do you think?
It's a huge relief, isn't it? And I think that's how it was felt on the ground. Our friend Asko Kruchelnitsky, who's been out and about in and around Kramatorsk, which is near Chasiv Yar, which we mentioned at the top, that place that's bracing for a big Russian offensive any week now. Well, he's reporting that while everyone has been understandably very frustrated at the partisan wrangling that's delayed the decision, they're now pretty pleased that the deadlock is finally broken. Incidentally, he says that the Russians displayed their displeasure at that decision in characteristic fashion a few days ago. He wrote that the rumble of artillery and mortars has been the constant soundtrack around Chasiv Yar, but on Saturday night, after news of the congressional vote became known, there was a loud upsurge in Russian bombardment of the town and surrounding area, with missiles and drones also exploding close to Kramatorsk, which is where Asgold was. But I think this is rather telling, isn't it? We'll come on to the immediate military situation in a moment. But in a longer term, this is surely bad news for Russia, isn't it? I mean, Putin's strategy has been all along to keep grinding away in the expectation that sooner rather than later, the West's support for Ukraine will fade and Kiev's ability to resist will crumble. But this vote sends a very different message. If you think about it, Western resolve has actually held up remarkably well. I mean, Europe's finally getting its act together in terms of organizing a consistent military supply chain to Ukraine. And until at least the November elections in the United States, support from America is now pretty solid. So all this makes the Russian strategy of battling on and suffering huge losses in the process look increasingly costly without necessarily improving their military position or bargaining position, diplomatic position, when it comes to eventual peace talks. However, we've got to face facts all, haven't we? And the new military aid is not going to enable Ukraine to achieve its stated war aims and drive the Russians out of all its territory on current form. And in the meantime, they're facing this huge challenge with this predicted big Russian move against Chasiv Yar, aren't they?
Yeah, things have been tough and it's not going to turn around immediately. The Ukrainian army's had a particularly difficult few months with severe ammunition shortages, as we've mentioned many times, restricting its ability to contain Russian attacks while suffering also steady casualty rates. Not as high as the enemies, of course, but given the imbalance in manpower, they can ill afford to sustain these sort of casualties. And just as worrying, morale, as we've heard in recent episodes, has been suffering. And now they're facing another test in the shape of this upcoming predicted offensive. So just to sketch out the situation for a second, Chasiv Yar is a heavily fortified hilltop town just west of Bakhmut. Its importance is that it's a forward artillery base for the Ukrainian army, providing protection for some of the area's largest cities, including Kramatorsk and Slovyansk. If the Russians take it, the roles will be reversed and they will be threatened. It'll also be a huge psychological blow if it's lost, and the scene is now set for another bloody slogging match akin to the battles for Bakhmut and Avdiivka. The decision by Congress is unlikely to make much difference to the Ukrainians' ability to resist what looks like a very determined onslaught on the one hand, but on the other, I think the psychological advantage of knowing that help is on its way, and if they can get those shells into these forward areas quite quickly, and we're talking about the next week or two, that really will make a difference, Patrick, because, you know, even the most conservative estimates have been saying that the Ukrainians are able to fire one shell to every five Russian because of this shortage. And some, of course, go further than that, say it's one in 10. This is going to close that gap, and that is going to make an awful big difference when it comes to fighting a defensive battle.
Yeah, and you know, the Russians do stand to carry on taking very, very heavy losses, which has been the pattern for really all along, hasn't it? And they've been keeping up the attacks nonetheless, have been pressing forward for some time now. On Sunday, the Kremlin claimed its forces took Bohdanivka, which is a sort of village just to the northeast on the approach to Chasiv Yar. There's been no independent confirmation of that. Kiev previously admitted that Bohdanivka had been in a precarious situation. And referring back to Askold again, an officer told him a couple of days ago that Ukrainian forces had lost and then regained parts of Bohdanivka several times, but warned that his comrades had suffered many casualties in the process, and that if it went on like that for much longer, they might not be able to withstand these relentless Russian attacks. Now, in the light of what's happened in Washington, the Russians will surely be redoubling their efforts to get a result before the new weaponry and the new ammunition reaches the battlefield. So stand by for a very intensive period of fighting.
Okay, we're now going to talk to Justin Ling, the freelance journalist who's based in Montreal, who was name-checked on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. So a big welcome this week to Justin Ling. Justin's been doing a fair bit of traveling on the ground in Ukraine, and he's got some very interesting things to say about drone technology. Should we start with that, Justin? Welcome to the podcast, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm obviously a big fan.
Yeah, it's quite nice when so-called fans come on and they know a hell of a lot of information, which is tremendously useful for us as a podcast, and we hope our listeners will want to hear. Tell us a little bit about the drone technology first, Justin. You've just written a big piece for Wired magazine about this, and you seem to get extraordinarily good access. We know a lot of journalists on the ground in Ukraine at the moment. Many of them are old mates of Patrick, and very few of them seem to have the sort of access you've had. So tell us about the research you did for that piece and what you discovered.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been working around the space for some time now. You know, I was actually particularly kind of obsessed, as I think both of you were, with former General Zaluzhny's essay in The Economist about, you know, needing to innovate new solutions to this war, particularly his language around autonomous systems, uncrewed systems. And I, you know, just started hitting up some contacts I have in Ukraine, including some contacts I have here in Canada and the US and elsewhere, and just trying to get a sense of exactly kind of what a lot of that innovation looked like, right? To my mind, the Ukrainians were still largely sort of dependent on those Chinese-made drones that had been sort of retrofitted, to some degree, the Bayraktar drones, the Turkish-made offensive drones that we haven't heard a lot of recently, and then maybe some odds and ends that had been donated from Europe and the US and Canada. And it really was until I started having some conversations with some people here and over there that I started to appreciate the degree to which Ukraine had stood up its own drone industry in a massive way over the past year. And the extent to which it is operational, I think, is news to a ton of people, including those who follow this quite closely. And when I wound up over there, I had made some, you know, good contacts with people I've known for quite some time who live in Kyiv, with some government officials. And just suddenly I had, you know, this list of WhatsApp channels and contacts and conversations with Ukrainian defense executives and entrepreneurs who were saying like, oh yeah, come to our offices, come to our underground drone factory, you know, come visit, we'll show you around, we'll show you what's up. And it was unbelievably eye-opening. Like I was primed, to realize that these entrepreneurs were making big strides. I was not ready for the degree to which this operation had scaled up and had professionalized and had innovated some really unique solutions to the problems facing Ukraine right now.
How much of this is actually homegrown, Justin? Are these entrepreneurs? I assume they're mainly young. But a lot of them would have been operating outside the country before all this began. Has there been a kind of influx of a sort of brain power, if you like, to aid the war effort since February 2022?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's not as young as you'd think. I spoke to people who had been more in the software space. I spoke to people who had been doing largely robotics for film crews. I had talked to one guy who, I'm trying to get to his specifics on who these people are, but who had come from a very, very different space than drone technology. It was really funny and kind of surprising and encouraging the degree to which, you know, many of the people in the space had sort of just applied themselves had, you know, surrounded themselves with smart people who knew what they were doing and had managed to kind of scale up, you know, these operations in pretty quick order. You know, I visited this one basically underground drone factory, you know, behind a steel door. You know, you had to be let in from the inside, you know, some pretty good security systems in place. And inside was 30 3D printers operating in unison. The air quality in there was really terrible. Really not great. But there's a whole bunch of these, you know, 20 somethings who are, you know, soldering in a corner or sitting and using AutoCAD, the engineering software, designing these drone systems, trying to improve the models that they've already been working with. And it was really fascinating to watch them work. And these sort of little, you know, mini factories are operating all across Ukraine. And they are coming up with some really interesting solutions to the problem facing the Ukrainian armed forces. And when we're talking about kind of homegrown, I still was operating under this misapprehension that these, you know, mini factories would be largely importing the kit and sort of assembling them in Ukraine. But it's actually increasingly not the case. Those executives I spoke to told me that anywhere between about 40 to 80% of their drones are entirely manufactured in Ukraine. And for a couple of them, they're looking already at hitting 50, 60, 70, 80%. Some, I mean, are really ambitious. One executive told me he wants to have his drones be 100% Ukrainian made, from the software to the actual kind of model, to the rotorcopter blades, to the onboard chips, everything else. He wants it 100% Ukrainian made within the next 6 months. That's probably not realistic. You probably can't be making you know, semiconductors in Ukraine that quickly, despite some ambitions from Kyiv. But nevertheless, it underscores the fact that they're weaning themselves off Chinese, Taiwanese, American technology and increasingly making everything at home and making it quickly and in pretty high volumes, because other suppliers around the world are having a hard time keeping up with the Ukrainian demand. And they're finding themselves also competing with Russians, who are trying to buy the exact same kit from the exact same suppliers. And it's basically taking away their comparative advantage.
I mean, without going into too many details, Justin, and maybe you can't anyway, but one of the things we've been mentioning a lot on the podcast recently are the success of these long-range strikes. And I know that you mentioned in your email to me that there was apparently a unit with a range that could wreak havoc on Russian supply depots that's about to be you know, introduced. What mystifies us is why the Russians aren't able to bring these things down. So what is it about them that enables them to fly such long distances relatively undetected?
So this is really fascinating stuff. So you know, I'll give you the kind of quick overview of who I was talking to. You know, in particular, I had this really great tour with a guy making really great FPV drones. You know, these are realistically 20, 30 kilometer range. They're cheaper. They can carry a grenade. They can maybe carry a missile. You know, pretty, the stuff you see on the front lines, that's basically replacing artillery shells. But I also had this really great conversation with a guy who represents a consortium who are financing and acquiring long range drones. And while he didn't say so explicitly, I'm pretty sure that some of his systems were the ones that have been hitting air bases and oil depots behind Russian front lines. His kit is really fascinating. He tells me none of this stuff comes from China, which is giving him a leg up against the Russians, which, because one of the drawbacks of buying Chinese kit is that it's much easier to plan for what you're facing. It's much easier to calibrate your electronic warfare systems to take them out of the sky more efficiently. And you're operating at kind of more predictable range of frequencies. If you're buying better technology from elsewhere, you're probably a little bit ahead of what the Russian EW systems can anticipate. What's more, both he and others have told me that their EW defenses are getting a lot better. So rather than operating on a single electromagnetic frequency as you fly towards your target, increasingly you're seeing these drone systems use two different antennas and hopping between different frequencies, as you know, potentially dozens of times a second. So it's harder for an electronic warfare system to lock on a single frequency to disrupt or spoof it and to bring the drone down from the sky. So you're seeing Ukraine already deploying some of these defensive tactics to overcome Russian EW systems. And it's probably one of the great secrets as to why some of these long-range drones are actually making it to their targets. I've also talked to some folks who are on the cutting edge of this who are telling me that they're increasingly planning their long-range drones to operate without communication back to base. So whether that's using basically onboard cameras, LiDAR, to use ground waypoints as a way of determining trajectory, or whether it's using AI to more effectively plan out that route. So you can actually have a drone mapping out the ground beneath it and adjusting its trajectory towards its target without ever communicating back to base along the front lines or in Kyiv or wherever else. That is really fascinating stuff. I don't know for sure whether that's the technology that's on board right now, but I know that's where a lot of this technology is going. But this guy who's building these long-range drones, you know, they're doing so for somewhere between $35,000 and $100,000 a unit, which is pretty cheap in the grand scheme of things. They're already reaching 1,000-kilometer range. They're talking very bluntly about 2,000 kilometers, maybe even further. That's really impressive stuff that has the capability to really change what this warfare looks like going forward. And he's pretty blunt. He says, you know, I want to bring this fight to Russia. I want to make them feel the pain that we're feeling. And that's very clearly what they're doing.
Well, that was absolutely fascinating. Do join us in part two to hear what Justin had to say about Canada's contribution to the Ukrainian war effort and also his thoughts about how things might go in Russia in the future.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Welcome back. Moving on to Canada and the Canadian government's response to the war in Ukraine. Justin, you've been a little bit frustrated, as have we, at the you know, the relatively meager offerings coming from Canada. We had some talk a while ago, and I know you spoke about them too, about these CRV-7 rockets that could possibly have been donated, but apparently there are issues getting them there. You've got very good contacts in the Canadian government, including the Prime Minister and the Defence Minister. What have you heard recently about any kind of pivot in Canada's stance on this?
Yeah, so I had the chance to sit down with the Prime Minister actually about a week before I left for Ukraine in March, and I asked about those CRV-7 rockets, and he looked somewhat frustrated, I think. I think he's heard a lot about them in Canada in recent weeks, and the reality is they're old as hell, right? You know, the general who's been sort of encouraging that they get sent over is a bit of an older vintage, and I think when he was around, they were old even back then, and now they're positively ancient, right? So they're sitting in a warehouse. I've been told by some folks who are familiar with it that they're in terrible condition. It's not so much the problem of logistics of getting them there; it's the safety of getting them there, right? You know, it's not easy to move munitions, particularly ones that may have been sitting in poor conditions, exposed to humidity, so on and so forth. So there's an actual, you know, nobody wants exploding rockets arriving in Kyiv, right? So I'm told that's the main part. The Prime Minister assured me that they're looking into it, and if they can reasonably send, they're going to be sent. Clearly, the Ukrainians are aware that these are old and probably not fully operational. I think it's relatively clear that they want them to potentially disassemble them to use maybe the shells or the components inside. But it's a bit of a distraction because these rockets are not the most important thing we could be sending. Canada still has Leopard 2 tanks we haven't dispatched. We are probably out of anti-air missiles. But we do have some other capabilities, night vision goggles, for example, that could be sent over that we're still sort of clinging on to. And I think that you're going to see pressure start mounting for Canada to step up, like the Czech Republic has stepped up, like the UK has stepped up, like other countries have managed to sort of get over themselves and actually kind of get their act together.
Is there much public pressure on Canada to do more? Is that something that's causing any political problems for the leadership?
So no is the short answer, right? I mean, Canada's experiencing many of the same pressures that the U.S. and elsewhere are experiencing. You know, inflation is high, cost of living is high. The leader of the opposition, Pierre Poilievre, has recently kind of gone from being quite critical of the insufficiency of Canada's response to being critical that it's doing what it's doing, right? He has actually, to some degree, campaigned against some of Canada's cooperation with Ukraine and has gotten hell for it amongst the Ukrainian community in Canada, which is huge. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, right? You know, people are starting to question why we're sending so much money to Ukraine when we have problems at home. The same sort of rhetoric you see informing the Republicans in the U.S. So it's frustrating, and clearly the wind is not at the sails of those who want to do more. But generally speaking, there's still a high level of support in Canada for Ukraine. And I think for the right move, for the right action, I think you'll still see some pretty widespread public support.
And lastly, Justin, when you contacted us, you agreed with us that the you know, the possibility of Putin being brought down by those close to him was, you know, unlikely, frankly, to say the least, in the near to medium future. But there are some interesting developments with other figures within the sort of wider Russian orbit who are acting to try and bring down the regime from within. And you spoke to one, Ahmed Zakayev, the leader of the Chechen Republic of Ishkeria, who, you know, is involved in some of these movements where you are getting armed groups supported by Ukraine, of course, causing trouble on the fringes of Russia at the moment, but potentially, you know, for bigger rebellions within Russia itself. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. So, you know, I've been kind of fascinated by this for a while now. I actually, before I headed to Kyiv, I was in Vilnius in Lithuania meeting with Vladimir Milov. He's one of Navalny's former associates who's working, you know, with some of the more liberal-minded reformers in Russia. I headed to Ukraine. I met with Zakayev, as you mentioned. I also met with a guy who runs the Free Russia Forum, the sort of meeting place for a lot of the separatist groups and dissident groups from across Russia. And between the three of them, it's a really interesting picture, right? The Western attention continues to be on those around Navalny, this idea that there's going to be at some point a movement to oust Putin and we'll need some sort of alternative to put him in place. And that still kind of captures the attention and the imagination of many in kind of the NATO world. But people like Zakayev, they're really blunt. You know, they're basically saying we can't just replace, you know, one, you know, imperialist president with another president who wants to keep together this completely unworkable Russian Federation, right? You know, their argument is that Russia is essentially built on imperialism, the very structure of its sort of, you know, network of quasi-independent republics, you know, kind of all governed out of Moscow, is just kind of fundamentally unworkable long-term and will continue to see sort of aggression against its neighbors so long as it kind of keeps the structure. Many of the dissident groups that could sort of exist, whether it's in Siberia, whether it's in the Far East, whether it's in Leningrad Oblast, or any of these places, there are movements afoot that have long been suppressed by Putin and the FSB that have sought independence and kind of freedom from the Russian Federation. And for people like Zakayev and Magletsky and the Free Russia Forum, you know, they really see the future in a kind of post-imperial Russia. And but the problem is that the West is if anything kind of fundamentally hostile to the idea of kind of breaking up the Federation. They're terrified of the idea of, you know, an independent Chechen Republic, for example. You know, they're still sort of wrapped up in the you know, the anxiety of the fall of the Soviet Union in the 90s, and then the anxiety of the post 9/11 war on terror. So there's not really been a Western sort of recognition that a disintegration of the Russian Federation is probably the best thing for both European security and for the Russian people themselves.
Fascinating stuff.
Thanks so much for that. That's absolutely brilliant.
Well, that was really enlightening. We just got time for a few of your questions. A lot of them we hope we'll have answered in the first half. But before we get to that, Saul has something to say.
Yeah, we've got a fascinating message from Jason, our fellow podcaster in the stable. He runs the Disorder podcast, which I'm going to be appearing on in a few weeks' time. But Jason just wanted to flag up a really interesting two-part series they've got. It started on Tuesday this week. It's going to repeat next week. And it coincides with Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day with Dr. Armen Sarkissian. He's a former leader of Armenia. And it's really a hell of a coup to get this interview with Dr. Sarkissian, and they are discussing some really fascinating topics over both this week and next week. So do listen to that if you get a chance. That's the Disorder podcast. Okay, we've got an email here from Emir Krupic in Ukraine, and Emir has contacted us a number of times. So thanks for getting back in touch. And he writes, and this is relevant, of course, to what Justin's just been saying about Canadian contribution. Emir is actually defending the Canadians. He says they may not have been contributing much in terms of fiduciary responsibility, as he puts it. Their defense spending is only 1.5% of GDP compared to the 2.5% the UK is now going to. But they have had boots on the ground here since 2015. Quite frankly, writes Emir, without them here getting our army up to NATO standards almost the entire 7 years before 2022, we would have been in far worse shape to take on Russia. So thanks for that, Emir. I mean, it is an interesting perspective. I personally didn't realize there'd been Canadians there that long, but that's good to hear. Question here from Chris. He says, love the excellent podcast. I have a question about how you think things will pan out with the Russian assault on Ukraine once Putin is out of the picture. Who are the likely contenders to replace him? That's optimistic, Chris. But who are the likely contenders to replace him? And will they be as ideologically driven to continue the war? Will a new Russian leader ever admit that it has all been a colossal error? Patrick, any thoughts?
Well, this is again is something that Justin just touched on, wasn't it? But I think the truthful answer is that no one has the faintest idea of a scenario that would lead to the ousting of Putin. And if that came to pass, who would replace him? However, I would suggest that whoever it is, they'd be unlikely to want to continue a war which Russia has essentially already lost, if you think about it. Just the casualties. We know for certain that 50,000 have already died on the battlefield, and the number is almost certainly very much higher. The economy is being run into the ground to finance the war, and Russia is now a pariah in the West, with its diplomatic space essentially restricted to alliances with extremely unsavory states like Iran and North Korea. And the supposed partnership they've got with China is pretty lopsided. It benefits Beijing much more than Moscow, I would say. So my bet would be that the successor or successors would call a halt and either explain that away by blaming the disaster on Putin or continuing the existing narrative that it's all NATO's fault, but the Russian people need a respite until they can return to the fray at some conveniently vague future date. I think even the most nationalistic-minded successor is going to have to impose some kind of breathing space just to kind of regroup at the very least if and when Putin goes. So the answer very simply is that I think the chances are the war would not continue at least at the same tempo. As to a Russian leader ever admitting that it had been a colossal error, I wouldn't hold your breath on that one.
Paul from Sydney writes, a while back you were scoffing mildly at the idea that one could become an ace pilot by shooting down drones. As it happens, during World War II, RAF pilots who downed five or more V1 flying bombs were designated V1 aces. There is even a book all about it, V1 Flying Bomb Aces by Andrew Thomas. So yes, in fact, you could become an ace by downing drones, although there was a distinction made between that and being a conventional ace for downing manned aircraft. Thanks for the info on that, Paul. He adds, if a modern pilot did manage to shoot down five drones, then I think they could legitimately claim to be a drone ace. However, and this was where we originally started discussing this, the pilot named in the original article, Marine Corps Captain Earl Earhart, is definitely not an ace of any kind and didn't actually shoot down any drones. The claim made in the article was wrong, caused by some very sloppy reporting, and the US Navy quickly corrected the BBC on this point. His final comment is, are there any Ukrainian drone aces, given the Ukrainian Air Force has been shooting down drones since the war began? Maybe you could ask some Ukrainian contacts. Don't know the answer to that. We will ask that question. It strikes me that, yes, a lot of drones, of course, have been taken out, but I don't know the details of this, Patrick. I don't know if you've heard anything, but I suspect most of them have been brought down by fire from the ground, missiles and anti-aircraft fire, rather than planes themselves, which, yeah, for the Ukrainians are actually quite dangerous to put up in the air at the moment. But I might be wrong on that. We will look into that further.
Okay, we've got one here from Alan in the UK who says, I can't help but feel that the main need for Ukrainians at the moment is ammunition, not necessarily new vehicles or even tanks. Would it not be best, therefore, for the UK or the US to put their recent military aid budgets primarily into supplying ammunition, or more crucially, in creating new ammunition production centres in the UK, US, or in Ukraine itself? What are your thoughts, he asks? Well, some of this is already going on, isn't it? We were talking in recent weeks about Germany increasing ammunition production, although, you know, they're late getting started and it'll be a while before capacity comes anywhere near producing the volumes needed. But there has been quite a lot of thought gone into this. Listeners will remember the initiative that was begun by the Czech Republic earlier this year. And that was searching around other countries around the world for supplies for Ukraine's artillery and rocket systems, you know, particularly the 152 millimeter shells for the Soviet era artillery and the NATO caliber 155 millimeter rounds and rockets for Western weaponry. So, yeah, I mean, something is happening on that front.
Yeah, and just to add quickly to that, because there's a little bit of detail coming out about the increased defence spending in the UK over the next 5 or 6 years. And one element of that is putting up to $10 billion into the development of new weapons, including hypersonic missiles, apparently, but also drones and artillery ammunition and other things that are really at the cutting edge and certainly in the short to medium term will help not just Ukraine, but also NATO more generally. So I think we're moving in the right direction, Alan. We feel your frustration. We've been voicing it for a long time, but we're getting there slowly but surely.
Okay, that's it for this week. Do join us on Wednesday for another episode of Battleground 44 and on Friday when we'll be returning to Ukraine. Goodbye.